Thank you very much to all the participants this afternoon who have dialed in for the Voices of ACA session. I'd like to thank Weber Training for making this event possible this afternoon. This is a new forum for ACA to be using. We hope that you find it beneficial and you learn some new things as we go along the discussions this afternoon. In registering for the event, you are asked to provide any questions by email to my email address, which if you miss the detail, I'll just give that to you again. So over the next hour, you're invited to put in any questions directly to myself, and at the end of the session, I will read them out and direct the questions as appropriate. My email address is Claire, C-L-A-I-R-E, underscore, Boardman, B-O-A-R-D-M-A-N, at health.qld.gov.au. At the end of the session, there will be members of the National Consultative Steering Committee available to take your questions, as well as Philip Russo, the Chair of the Committee. Again, thank you very much for joining this afternoon. For some of you, this information will be new. For others, you may have heard some of the content before, particularly in the last couple of years as we've started to talk about what the reasons are to change our structure. Many of you would be aware that ACA last year celebrated 25 years in Australia, and our membership at some points in time has increased, but we're actually declining, unfortunately, over the last couple of years. But we do have a membership of around 1,200, mainly in Australia, but also some of our neighbouring countries. For those of you who aren't aware, the ACA executive is actually appointed by each state and territory association. They're not individually elected to those positions. And as part of the ACA constitution and as part of your own state and territory rules of an association, the terms that those people can set can sit on the committee is entirely dependent on what the rules of the association in each state or territory dictate. So, for example, some people might sit for a year, some for 4 years, some can seek to extend their term dependent on what the rules of the association is. And that's one of the inherent difficulties for ACA, is that we're bound by the rules of each state association, and there's often loss of that corporate memory as people move on to take up other positions within their state executive or to move outside of the field or to just go back to the general membership in their own state. We have experienced over a number of years that initially was mooted by Dolly Olson and then Rachel Thompson, a number of significant challenges to meet the needs of the membership. And we have discussed at length over the last couple of months, last 18 months in particular, what some of those challenges are. Hopefully each of you are following the PDF PowerPoint presentation that was available once you registered for the teleclass today. I'm just on slide 3. I'll just make note of where I'm up to in case any of you are getting lost. From an internal working perspective, the ACA executive provides numerous representation on various committees. Of note, though, we work quite closely with the Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare. And many of you would be well and truly aware of the release of the National Infection Control Guidelines, also some of the new outcomes for the Antimicrobial Stewardship Group, and definitely the National Hand Hygiene Initiative and the Surveillance Committees. The Implementation Advisory Committee is perhaps the most important from a professional development perspective, whereby we've been looking at guidelines for clinical practice for infection control professionals and actually determining what the scope is in everyday workplace. We also have a number of external partnerships that some of you might not be aware of. Within Australia, we have representation with Standards Australia, also ACHS. There's been a typo, something's happened to the next point, but it's HIGSIG or AZID as many of you are familiar with. ASHM and a number of university linkages. But from an international perspective, we have good partnering relationships with IFIC, HIS, which is the UK-based organisation that's recently changed its name, APIC, the National New Zealand Council of Organisations, which is actually under a different structure to what we have in Australia, and I welcome any of our New Zealand counterparts if they're listening in today, APSIC, and more recently, developing links with our neighbours in Sri Lanka, WHO and the GORN training program. For those of you who don't know what GORN is, it's the Global Outbreak and Response Network, which provides allocated training spots for our credentialed infection control professionals to participate in week-long training that enables them to be deployed in the field. So, for example, they can be sent to disaster situations or outbreak situations. specifically for their expertise, background knowledge and qualifications in infection control. And about 18 months ago, several of us, as part of an ACRA initiative with the United Arab Emirates, provided an infection control course in three different areas of the Emirates, which is hoped to be repeated perhaps more locally next time around. We have a number of priority areas. Healthcare Infection Journal, which many of you would have opened up and had a look at very recently. We have four editions come out each year. And this year we're seeking Medline indexation, which is an exciting time for ACA, and we're hoping to find out how we go around October. The Healthcare Infection Journal is led expertly by our journal editor, who is Elizabeth Gillespie, who resides in Victoria. Our credentialing committee is well led by Deborah Macbeth, who many of you in Queensland would know. And in terms of education and research, we're starting to really develop these areas. Education, many of you would have been aware of the recent construction and renovation in hospital workshops that were held in most capital cities, with further workshops planned for this year and next, but in a slightly different forum and on different topics. Research and development is a core area of interest in terms of developing our business capabilities as an association, which at present our structure doesn't allow us to put in for research grants that we should really be going after, and also to work in partnership with some of our external partners to develop some of these areas. Representation is often challenging. The work of the ACRA executive is full. We have very few spare minutes. Most of us have full-time day-to-day jobs. We also have a national database. We are asking for experts to sign up to that and provide their expertise so that we have more people to call on as we're asked to review documents and to provide representation. Overall, though, representation is lacking from the general membership, and that's something we would certainly like to see improved in a revised structural model. The feedback from external partners and also internally is that ACA is a respected voice. We have some very professional services that are available to members, and we're well regarded in the industry. We work particularly well with a couple of key bodies. I won't mention all of them, but 3M in the Marketing for Infection Control Program, or the Infection Control Professionals that's planned. COVIDian, the annual scholarships, and they have just been announced again, and all applications are due in by June 30th, so I invite the general membership to put in an application for the COVIDian scholarships. The BD Six Sigma training that was held a couple of years ago that was intended to improve performance in the workplace with respect to picking up on specific activities using the Six Sigma approach, where you could establish outcomes and evaluation of those particular areas that you decided to apply the Six Sigma training to. ASHM is our appointed PCO for the 2012 National Conference, and CSIRO, of course, is the publisher for the ACA Journal. So some of the challenges that we've faced, and many of you would have seen this slide before, is that we've got significant limitations for growth and development in the existing structure. There's also about several issues regarding confusion about changing agendas and whether we're really committed to the membership in providing representation on the projects that we're asked to participate in. Perhaps the biggest concern for me as president is the lost opportunities due to the organisational current structure. There's many things we would like to follow up on. There's many opportunities to comment to media. However, we've got a very small contingent of people that can be referred to do that sort of work, and at short notice. It would be great to see in the future that ACA not only is a strong body, whatever we might be named and whatever our structure, but that we are the first port of call for any infection prevention and control issues in the community, anything that comes up in the media. I think this is a growing relationship that we have with media, but it's certainly something that can be improved and a key target area for the future. So why do we need to change? Well, overall, there's a lot of duplication of effort. And Phil's going to talk to you about the work of the National Consultative Steering Committee. And as part of the initial review that they did in planning for a revised structure, was looking at some of that duplication and effort. We're not operating as cost-effectively as we could. There's different ways of communicating with members, and often the messages are lost or confused, and there's no one concise, clear message that comes through. inevitably there's going to be financial constraints about some of the services that are currently offered. In the future, we're hoping that with a revised business model, we can certainly enhance the existing membership services and explore new and develop others. So what will happen? As you know, we went through a consultative process of appointing. First of all, we started to plant the seed with discussion around the future needs and started to talk with people on the ground and at various state and territory and national meetings. In June 2010, the ACRE exec agreed to explore other business operating models, and from July to August, we started to communicate with members regarding the proposed changes. We also commenced consultation with the state and territory presidents and executive members, and also had initial consultation with MORS Legal, our appointed representatives in law. We also started to look at other business models and to see what is making them competitive and efficient and more accessible and open to changing membership services. In September 2010, we began to advertise nationally for six members to form the Consultative Steering Committee, which I'll refer to as the Steering Committee as we go through this talk. And there was further communication to the members. Excuse me. Then in October 2010, we voted at the AGM to review the structure and establish the Consultative Steering Committee. Late December, the members of the Consultative Steering Committee were appointed, as was the chair. We're very pleased to have Philip Russo, who's well known to most Australian infection control consultants and also internationally, as our appointed chair. And he's going to give you an overview of the workings of the committee shortly. An external secretariat was appointed to support the work of the Consultative Steering Committee because during this phase, which is a transitional phase, and depending on what is recommended and the outcomes are of the revised structure from November, there will still be a transition phase, which I'll come back to at the end of the presentation after Phil has spoken, just to fill you in a little bit more about how that might progress. But in appointing an independent secretariat, it means it allows the excellent work of Lauralee Broadbent, who does a fantastic job in supporting the current ACRE executive and the ACRE executive, to keep working on all the things that don't just fall by the wayside because we're reviewing structure. The terms of reference and code of conduct and a number of other documents were established and handed over to the Consultative Steering Committee. The purpose of that committee was to look at organisational restructure and to set priorities for action, establish realistic timelines and provide advice and assistance to the ACRE executive on the progress of work. Also to provide the General Steering Committee is to provide support to the Chair, Phil Russo, and to deliver a proposed model by September. The terms of reference included looking at a new model for a national entity, consulting widely. There's three consultative phases that you would be familiar with if you've read and commented on the white paper that's recently been released. Work to facilitate outcomes in conjunction with the appointed chair, to work with MORS Legal and to agree timelines. So in summary, from an ACRE president perspective, it's imperative that at this time we all work together, move toward change, have feedback and say in what you would like your revised national structure to look at. And at the end of the session, I'll come back and discuss some of the transitional issues. And at this point, I'd like to hand over to Phil. And just for a note, for any of those who have joined late, if you can remember to send any questions via email to my address, and we'll endeavour to answer those at the end. Phil, I'd like to hand over to you. Thanks.
Thanks, Claire. Thank you, everybody, for joining us online. As chair of the steering committee, I've just got to start by saying what an interesting job it's been so far. And on behalf of the committee members, we'd like to thank the ACRE executive for the opportunity to be involved in this review. It's certainly been very interesting and rewarding. We'd like to also extend our gratitude to the membership and also to each of the state and territory associations, because the cooperation has been fantastic to date so far, and the sharing of information has certainly made our position much easier. So thank you for that. I'm going to just call out the slide number as I go through this talk. There's a fair few slides there, and there'll be a few that I'll be skipping through quickly, and we'll end up with some questions at the end after I've handed back to Claire. So, strangely, I'm going to ask you to go to slide 14 before slide 13 because I got them mixed up. And slide 14 is just, I want to make a point that the content of the presentation is intended to be accompanied by the explanation that I'll be providing specifically for this teleclass. And because of the ability for information to slightly change out of context, then the purpose of what I'm saying is really for this teleclass. If you skip back to slide 13, the work that we've done to date, what we did in the first quarter was as you would know, we've set up a website. We've been able to review a lot of the existing structures of the associations and similar bodies. As part of consultative round one, we held meetings with the ACA executive and each of the state and territory associations and have also provided regular reports to the ACA executive. Round two, which is what we're currently in, we have asked for a consultation with the ACA membership. And there are a number of ways that we are doing that, and this is one of those, the teleclass. As you'd be aware, we've posted all our documentation for review and comment up on the website, as well as a survey, and we'll be reviewing all that feedback shortly. And early in this talk, and I'll do it again later on, a reminder to, if you haven't already, to read that documentation and complete the online survey by the end of business on Friday the 13th. The part three of the consultation is going to be, we'll review the feedback and go back to the ACA executive. And if we go to slide 15, the fourth consultation round is where we will open it up to the community to review and provide feedback on a model that has evolved following this consultation. fourth quarter then is the possibility of launching the new national organisation. I say possibilities because at this stage the committee itself is very open-minded and responding to membership feedback, and will formulate the model that that the members are indicating that they want. Moving on to slide 16, just to give you an idea, this is the process that we went through, consulted with all of the state and territory association plus the executive, and then went back to each of the state and territory association presidents on the 31st of March. Slide 17 just gives you an idea of the number of visits that we have seen that has occurred through our website, and that continues to increase and has increased recently a lot because of the online survey. And slide 18 just gives you and also gives us an idea of where people are coming from who visit the website, and it breaks it down by city representation there. So that we continue to observe that to see if we need to perhaps address certain areas where we're not seeing much interest from. Slide 19 provides a list of the bodies that the steering committee have reviewed, and what we did as part of this was we looked at the organisational structure, we looked at the type of membership categories and options, and where possible we looked at the finances of each of these groups. And the reason we looked at these is was because they were either similar to what we're trying to do here in Australia, or had gone through that process, and as you can see there, they're not all specifically health related, but there are certainly plenty of bodies that have gone from being individual state and territory into a national body. Slide 20 really just points out what the steering committee believes the new proposed model offers membership, and that's really a lot of emphasis on increasing education and scholarship opportunities, the ability to be involved in research, networking not just through geographical regions but through special interest groups, an increase in information technology, particularly with delivery of online education, an annual national conference, and more options for membership. And as you might have already seen, that the standard full membership fee we propose to be at $145. So going on to slide 21, there are seven key points to the proposal. And the first one is a new name. The second one is a new structure which has an executive council and representation from state and territory, consumer and operational representation. The creation of a general manager and executive officer and other paid administrative roles. The creation of four subcommittees. Number five, an increased level of education and resource support through special interest groups, a broad range of workshops, educational workshops, national conference, and increased use of technology. Seven levels of membership and a 10-year business plan, and I'll speak to each of those briefly now. So the slide 23, the steering committee considered that these words were probably important in a name or title of a new national body. As you will have hopefully noticed, that we have put some suggested names in the white paper, and we will be, through the online survey, we have asked the participants to indicate to us if they have a preference for one or more of those names, and also if they would like to offer an alternative name. So what we intend to do with that information is to probably come up with a short list of names that have seemed to be the most popular, including names that are offered, and then ask the members to indicate which one of those they would prefer. Slide 24 is a diagram of the proposed organisational structure. And as you can see there, it's headed by an executive council, of which there's a president, various levels of membership. They're supported by an executive officer, and they also oversee the running of the four subcommittees. Slide 25 just provides you a bit more detail of the personnel within those groups. And the president would be elected by a vote of the full membership, and there would be specific eligibility criteria, including membership and professional standing. The president would have full voting rights on that council. What came back very strongly in our discussions with the state and territory associations was there was a concern that their members would feel a loss of identity and be disassociated by an executive council. Subsequently, we feel it's important that this first executive council have representation from each of the state and territory bases. And so, hence you have the first seven members there. Three elected general members who not necessarily going to be, who won't be representing a particular state or territory, and one consumer representative as well, and they would be voted by the executive council. Just point out to you that also on point three of that slide there, that typo that four should be three elected general members. Going down to point five, the general manager would be paid position. They'd be appointed by the Executive Council and they'd be a non-voting member, and all that would be supported by the executive officer, who would also be a paid member and appointed by the Executive Council. So if we go on to slide 26, and it just outlines the role of that Executive Council to provide overall strategic direction of the national body. So they would have a very important role. To determine internal policies and governance, enter an agreement with the General Manager to manage the national body, to approve the business plans and budgets, and to review the annual performance of the national body and act as an interface between the General Manager and stakeholders. Moving on to slide 27, they would also approve a delegations register authorising relevant staff to carry out actions on behalf of the body, approve capital expenditure, provide feedback on the performance of the General Manager, establish and determine the powers and functions of the committees of the national body, and review the terms and conditions of senior management through an annual performance review. And the last point there, it's important to note that we are proposing that the Executive Council members would receive remuneration for the work that they do on this council. We're very aware that the existing state and territory associations often find it very difficult to attract members to participate on the executive of those particular bodies, and a lot of that we are getting feedback is because people are very time poor, there's no financial remuneration for it, and they don't feel as if they have the appropriate skills. So we feel it's important to attract good quality people to volunteer to go onto the Executive Council, to put their hands up to go on the Executive Council, that they be remunerated appropriately. Going on to slide 28, the general manager, the paid positions, and that their general manager would be responsible for the financial, human resource, service development, quality performance management of the of all services of the association. We also thought it likely that the general manager would also be involved in at least one of the subcommittees. The executive officer would devise and implement targeted education programs and apply for sponsorship of grants to support education programs and development of the clinical guidelines, policies and position papers. And we've also included that there would need to be appropriate secretarial and administrative support services, and not only for that Executive Council but also for the subcommittees too. Slide 29, we start talking about the subcommittees, and the first one is the Credentialing and Professional Standards Committee. And we see that really as an extension of the existing ACCA Credentialing Committee to include the professional standards issue, and so not only to carry out credentialing of members, but to determine, develop, promulgate and publish professional standards relating for infection prevention control across Australia, and to advise and recommend to the ACCA National Steering Committee regarding credentialing professional standards. On the next slide, the Education and Research Committee, to develop, promote and facilitate educational material for national body members, promote and facilitate education of national body members in local and national infection control policies and procedures, to advise and recommend to the National Body Executive Council educational opportunities and awareness of provide leadership relating to infection control issues. And we see that one of these roles would also be very much going out and attracting funding grants for the national body as well. The Policy and Publication Committee would be to deal with not only continue on with the publication of the journal Healthcare Infection, of which all members will receive, but also to develop evidence-based policies and to advise and recommend to the National Steering Committee regarding policy and publication in the early days. Finally, the last committee on slide 23 would be the Special Interest Group Advisory Committee, and this leads me into our next point, which is on education and research support. So the Special Interest Group Advisory Committee would establish, lead and oversee functions and activities of the Special Interest Groups. As a standard benefit for all full members, access and eligibility to be part of two special interest groups is included in that membership. And what we have there is a list of what the steering committee believed might attract the interest of membership in developing special interest groups. And this is something that we do need to get responses from via the survey, and we are starting to get those through the online survey, and it's already been indicated to us that there are a few there that probably wouldn't have a huge membership, and there is a couple there that would seem popular. So again, we encourage you to go and do that online survey if you haven't done that. But certainly that's not a comprehensive list, and there has been a number of suggestions of other groups, of special interest groups that could be formed that haven't been part of that list there. So going on to slide 33, the special interest group, the increased education and resource support, and special interest groups have already spoken to an extensive range of educational workshops, which I'll talk to in the next slide, an annual national conference, and an increased use of technology. So with the annual national conference, as everybody would be aware, the general run at the moment is that in alternating years, each state and territory more or less has their own local conference, and then in the other year there is a national conference. So the proposal is that every year there would be a national conference, so there'd be no further state and territory conferences, and that national conference would be rotated through the cities. We believe this would be a good option because it would remove some of the duplication that we've been identifying in these areas, and we believe it will also attract good industry funding. Depending on the skill set of the staff who would be forming part of the Executive Council and also the Secretariat, it may be that the running of the conference could be outsourced, or it could also be run by some members of the executive, again, depending on the skill set of those appointed. The increased use of technology, we believe as a steering committee that because Australia is such a huge geographical area, we go across three, sometimes four different time zones, that the use of technology must be adopted to network appropriately. And we're very open-minded as to how this could be done. It's through these sorts of teleclasses, video conferences, webinars, VoIP applications, blogs, instant messaging, social networking should all be explored by the Executive Council and appropriate forms identified. Not only for education delivery, but also for special interest group and other communications on a regular basis. Slide 34 there, we have a sample of education modules which we believe would be of benefit to the members, and these are included in the white paper, and we also request feedback and responses in our online survey. And already we're getting some good suggestions. Other education modules have included that have been suggested to us negotiation skills, change management, and leadership courses, which would be of beneficial, particularly to the experienced infection control people. So these are all things that that it's really good to get feedback from, and we're seeing that through our online survey. The slide number 35, we talk about the various levels of membership, which is new. And first up is the full membership at $145, so the full voting rights, access to interest groups, receive the journal and the newsletter, and access to infection connection, reduced costs for specific activities, education conferences, ability to apply for scholarships, and access to position policy papers that would be developed and posted via the website, webinars, and able to apply for credentialed status. What's new is the last item there, and that is the ability to use notation M followed by the new organisation's abbreviation. And to date, we've had very positive feedback about that. Slide 36, we talk about, we offer institutional membership, depending on the number of individuals who would be included in that membership, determines the cost and the specific benefits there are listed. The main difference to full membership is that there are no voting rights, and they are not eligible to be credentialed. Slide 37, we have the student membership there, same as full except for no voting rights. A new category which is used in other similar organisations is a fellow, a membership of fellow, and they would be that membership would cost more. They'd be able to use the notation F followed by the organisation's abbreviation. And then finally, on this slide, an international membership for a developing country. They would have the same entitlements as a full member, and a developed country would cost $160. Now, this has created some discussion in our responses. The reasoning behind this level of membership was that already there are a number of very strong connections between some of the associations, our neighbouring countries, particularly the developing neighbouring countries, and it would be a good thing to continue to have that relationship with the areas, and particularly if we're looking to expand and grow and have a strong financial basis in the future, we need to also look beyond the borders of Australia, but into the both developing and developed neighbouring countries. Slide 38, a corporate membership there of $2,000, certain benefits there, and the life membership would be closed, though the existing life members would continue to be recognised. Finally, with the membership, the full membership offers the membership to two special interest groups at an additional fee of $10 per group. Members would have the option to join other special interest groups also. And so slide 39, we talk about the finances. And the steering committee spent some time in developing the business model and reviewing the finances. And so the way this evolved was that we had the opportunity to look at each of the state and territory associations' current financial status, and the including the expenditure and income of each of those associations. And from that, we had to start building a business case for this new model. So the business plan that we have developed to date is based on the assumption that each association will make available all their existing finances. And we needed to start somewhere, so we thought that would be a good place to start. When we reviewed all the activities, expenditure of each of these associations, it was quite revealing to note that there is much duplication, particularly in regards to secretarial accounting, auditing, insurance, website, legal fees, and conference fees amongst all the associations. And some of the associations possibly would be expected to be extremely wealthy on a per capita, per member basis, in fact, were not as wealthy as some of the others. So it was an interesting activity, and we were able to look across the board at how much money currently has been spent in the past couple of years on education and scholarship opportunities. And so with all that information, we sat down and started to build the model. So the model we've come up with in slide 39 is that year one and two run at a significant loss to establish the association, and that's in the expectation that there are fees associated with winding down each of the state and territory bodies and starting up a new national body. It is believed that by year five, the new body will break even, and a 10-year conservative budget estimates that by year 10, there will be over $400,000 in the bank. And this, the business case is very conservative, and it's also one of those conservative assumptions is there is no increase in membership in the first 5 years' membership numbers. So slide 40 is a chart that provides, hopefully illustrates to you where we see ourselves, where we see the new body over the first 5 years and then by year 10. So you can see there that the cash balance starts off reasonably healthy but then dips for the first few years, and that's due to the start-up of the association, but it does level out eventually. And importantly, the profit loss line, as I indicated earlier, is runs at a loss for the first 2 years, but by year three, or certainly by year four, breaks even and starts to go up after year four and head upwards to year 10. Slide 41, there are some significant items to note, and that is that the model provides a fourfold increase in education investment and a threefold increase in scholarship investment. So as a rule, the general membership will have many more opportunities for education and scholarship. And we have sensed that there's probably about 25 annual scholarships available for all members, in addition to any corporate and industry scholarships. It's important to point out also that the scholarships, everybody is going to start off on a level pegging at will not matter which state or territory somebody comes from. That's not going to be considered in our model. There are 25 annual scholarships available for all members, regardless of their origin. On slide 42, we give an illustration of the expenses for year one. And as you can see, that just over 50% of that goes into the salaries and wages and employment of the staff. And so that'll be for those who sit on the executive committee and secretarial support also. But importantly, down the bottom there, scholarships and education makes up almost 20% of the expenditure. And looking at the expenditure over the 5 years, it doesn't change a lot from that picture. The next slide, 43, we thought it's important for members to realise exactly how things are now and what we are proposing in the future. So this is a comparison of the money spent on education, excluding conferences, combined the existing state and territory associations from 2009-2010 expenditure versus what is proposed in this new business model. So you can see there's a significant difference in the amount of money being spent. Similarly, on the right-hand side, scholarship investment. Again, we looked at expenditure in the past couple of years versus what we are proposing moving forward in the future, and again, a significant increase in scholarship opportunities there. So, in summing up, on slide 44, the steering committee proposed that a new name be identified, that the new structure be, as we have indicated, be adopted, that there be employed management, an executive council with specialist committees, the development of special interest groups, which will provide increased education, scholarship and research opportunities, will provide a strong financial base in the future, not only have a strong national but also a strong international identity, and we believe that the various membership packages will certainly be attractive and cover people's needs. So how can you participate? Again, I'm probably getting sick of me saying this, but we need to hear from the membership, and this is an opportunity for all Aiken members to have their say and to tell us what they think. So we strongly encourage you to go to the website and read the white paper. After having read that on slide 45, go to the next slide, we certainly invite you then to tell us what you think. And you can do that on two ways. First way is through completing the online survey, which takes about 10 to 15 minutes to complete, but we feel it's a very important survey. And also on that same page, there is a general feedback section of the website where you can tell us your thoughts, and you can ask for us ask us to respond to that. Just to give you an idea of what we've seen to date, the survey has now been open for 3 weeks, and as of this morning, on slide 47, as of this morning, we had received 118 survey responses, and this is a illustration there is illustrates the representation of those responses from the state and territories. So the highest number of responses there have been from New South Wales to date. On slide 48, one of the various questions, one of them is in regards to the national body and state and territory associations replaced by elected state and territory-based members, and to what extent are you in favour of this? And 92% either agree or strongly agree with this element of the structure to date. Going on to slide 49, there is a strong sense, almost 93%, that the levels of membership and associated benefits will suit professional needs. And on the next slide, that is good positive response there, that most people would be interested in participating and contributing to a special interest group, in a geographically based special interest group. So that's just a snapshot of our responses to date. But again, I encourage you, if you haven't already done so, to please go to our the steering committee website, read the relevant documentation, and complete the survey. So that brings me to an end of my talk. I am going to now hand back to Claire, who is going to talk to the 4 points on slide 51. Claire?
Thanks very much, Phil. And in case I forget, at this point I would like to acknowledge and thank each of the members of the Consultative Steering Committee for their significant work that they've put into developing a very professional white paper. Just anecdotally, the feedback that I've had as president is that it's been a good process for people to be part of, and that it's a very, very polished presentation that's been presented to the members. So again, I encourage all of you to have feedback on the white paper. Now, notably, it seems to be the same core group of committed infection control professionals. So potentially all those that are sitting in on the teleconference today have already provided feedback on the white paper. However, it's getting the message out to those that need to be engaged. As Phil said several times throughout his presentation, it's up to the membership and our success is very dependent on the input and the recommendations of the general membership. And unfortunately, it tends to be the same group of people that provide that feedback. It would be great to see feedback coming from different areas. Novices or new, those that are new to the profession may not feel particularly confident providing feedback. However, if they could have anything, this is now a good opportunity for them to provide with a fresh set of eyes, looking through new eyes, about what we should include in the new structure. And also, for those that might have been engaged previously over the years that have become disheartened or fallen, feel like they've fallen by the wayside, it's a chance for them to hopefully be reinvigorated and come back to some of the professional issues that are facing all of us at present. So thank you again, Phil, for your presentation. Just to conclude, and before I do, we've actually only received one question via email. So now is the last time, if you would like to raise any questions for the presenters, Phil and myself today, to send through an email now to my email address. And if there's a little bit of time, we might be able to open up the phone lines, but it's very dependent on whether there's a lot of background noise or not. But we'll see how that goes. Okay, so some of you might be interested in the legal process. Phil and myself met with our legal entity, Moores Legal, last week to discuss some of the legal implications for potentially winding up states as incorporated in each of your own state and territory bodies. So, for example, Victoria is incorporated under Consumer Affairs. There's a different body in Queensland, different one in New South Wales. But ACA is also incorporated under Consumer Affairs or Department of Justice in Victoria. So we need to set some quite clear criteria for how review of the rules will occur and what the actual process is for potentially winding up associations and during that transition phase. In the next coming weeks, members will receive information, particularly the state and territory executives and the presidents, will receive some quite clear criteria about how to approach that. And an example might be that if we're coming into a season of AGMs through to the end of the year, that the timing of this proposed structural change may not be optimal. So one of the solutions might be to actually call for a special general meeting where members of that state or territory association vote to change their constitution and, doing so, transfer over to a national entity. But more information will be provided in the next couple of weeks and in stage two of the consultating process. The other thing that some of you might be interested in, or possibly haven't actually given any thought to, is what sort of operating entity we will be. Phil mentioned that there's a number of options for a name change and our structure and our membership and various tiers of membership fees. However, we also need to ensure, as an executive, that we are well placed to be providing services in a competitive business model and what that might look like. For example, my states and territories operate under ATO laws of not-for-profit associations. We need to be very careful from a legal and tax perspective that as we embark on this process, we're ensuring that our assets are not at risk and that if we are potentially seeking to be investing in research and development or seeking sponsorship monies, etc., that we're not compromising our tax status in several areas. In terms of the constitution, of course, if there's a new body, we need a new constitution to be developed alongside that. And what I'm talking about is the rules of the association or the operating rules, or often it's called a constitution. So during this process, we also need to focus on developing the constitution, which we will do in consultation with the membership when it's ready, but in the first instance with Moores Legal, who will provide us with the expertise. And there's a number of options for doing that. They have templates that they've designed for other organisations who have gone through a similar change in structure. And then we would seek to include more specific information relevant to our national entity and our business operating rules. With regard to the transition status, this is an ongoing process. So although we've got an earmarked deadline for the consultative steering committee concluding their work, we can't just say that, for example, on the 1st of November, we're winding up the association, and 5 minutes later reopening as a new entity. If we haven't already put a constitution in place, if we haven't gone through an election process for the new potential nominated body people to sit on the new structure that's proposed. So it's anticipated that the existing ACRA executive would stay on potentially for another 6 months, so that we're not losing that corporate memory, that we're providing assistance to the new people coming onto the structure, and so that we've got time to wind up our day-to-day processes. So in terms of the transition, we're looking at least 6 months beyond the actual end point of this date. So in summary, at the same time that we're asking for feedback from the membership, we're also looking at the legal, the accounting and the transitional issues on the table. And for the ACRA executive and the work of the ACRA exec, pretty much it's business as usual on a day-to-day basis, and we won't just be closing up shop on the 1st of November if that's the date that's set. In our recent e-bulletin and also on our website, you will note that we have announced the AGM date, which is November the 9th, as part of the APSIC proceedings, which will be held in Melbourne. No doubt there'll be further discussion at that AGM, and again, we're seeking legal advice around the types of resolutions that we put to the new structure and the membership. So we've had a few more questions that have come through. I might start by just reading out those questions and then asking Phil and members of the Consultative Steering Committee to respond as appropriate. And then if there's time, we might just open up the phone lines depending on background noise. I'd like to stress that members of the Consultative Steering Committee, as well as members of the ACRA Executive, and particularly myself, are very keen to hear from members about how they think things are progressing, and also with any ideas and potential criticism. Now is the time to speak up and be included. Okay, so the first question that I have is from Matt Mason, who is in Queensland, who is asking, with regard to the special interest groups, Phil, is it possible, is it envisaged that you would be able to pay to join more than two special interest groups, or would it just be a, you know, flat membership amount for one interest group and the other one comes is included? Phil, are you able to respond?
Okay. So, Matt, the full membership entitles that member to entry into two special interest groups. If they wish to join others, they pay a fee of $10 per group.
Okay, that was a nice and simple one. Thanks, Phil. Okay, there's a question who comes from an infection control consultant, also in Queensland, Robin Birch, who would like to know if there's been any consideration as to whether there'll be a head office somewhere, or is it pretty much as we are now? I don't know if the consultative steering group would be able to answer that, but pretty much as it is now, the only office as such that is held is the only paid position that is held is by the Secretary at Lauralee Broadbent, who obviously manages our mail and serves as a key office or shopfront for all inquiries from the general membership. It's likely that something like that, a structure like that, will continue. I don't think we've had particular discussions around where a head office should be, and given that it's a national body with national representation, it will probably continue as it is now. However, I'd like to invite Phil and potentially members of the steering committee to respond. Maybe there's been some discussion further to that.
Sure, it's Phil here. We have had some very brief discussion about this, but given the way that it's going to be structured and run, and the use of technology for communication, it's probably a decision that's going to be based more on finances than anything else. If there needs to be property rented or something to that degree for the office holders, it may also be somewhat indicated by the type of people who apply for these positions. But we deliberately, I guess, have not been strong in exploring this issue because I don't think it's a key issue in the development of the structure. If there are other committee members online who'd like to make a comment, I invite them to do so.
Okay, is there committee members online that would like to make additional comments?
Claire, so let's Ramon.
John, Ramon.
I'd only say that to reiterate what Phil has just said, it wasn't not a particular high priority at this stage in terms of the work of the committee, and we would take some counsel from members and the executive and others as time went on.
Claire, it's Maria here.
John, Maria.
I have to agree with Phil and Ramon because I think it's something that needs further consultation from the rest of the executive council as opposed to, and the members, and it wasn't really something that was really high, as Phil said, and Ramon, a priority for us when putting this together.
Claire, it's Brett.
Go on, Brett.
Thanks. Just for those listening, in terms of the budget element of this, we had allocated a nominal figure for some costs that may be related to premise, but as has already been alluded, there's no detailed work undergone on that, but there is some money allocated should we need it already in the budget.
Thank you, Brett. Okay, well, that actually concludes the presentations, and we just had a couple of questions there at the end. So I invite any open comments, discussion from the membership who might be tuning in today.
Hi, Claire. It's Michael Wishart. We're promoting the term Australasian, and to me, the term Australasian means that the association is active in more than just the Australian country. And yet, in our membership, we're sort of suggesting that any membership outside of Australia will be more expensive than full membership within Australia. It's just something that just occurred to me as we were going through the presentation. Hadn't thought about it before. So, for example, if we're encouraging people in New Zealand to be members and we're calling ourselves an Australasian Association, then do we financially need to make their membership more expensive?
In the second and third consultative periods, we're actually opening it up to New Zealand for comment. There's been preliminary sort of informal discussions with the current president of NNZO Infection Control Group. One of the inherent difficulties for New Zealand, although they're welcome to provide feedback, is that their structure is very different to the Australian infection control structure. And in exploring any potential options, if New Zealand would like to be part of an Australasian group, is that, and it's very much up to the New Zealanders how they would like to do this and if they would be part of it. So I just want to preface anything I say by it is entirely up to New Zealand whether they would like to be part of whatever the proposed structure is. But I think it would be fair to say that the New Zealand Association is under a union structure, and any move to extricate themselves from that may result in a loss of any funds that they might have behind them and also a loss of any structure they might have behind them. So New Zealand would need to obviously consider all those additional points with respect to how that works in New Zealand. There is nothing stopping from any of the Kiwis wanting to join an Australasian society, and likewise for anyone throughout the Pacific region. Asia, as it stands at the moment, is represented through APSIC. Again, it could be open to any of the Australasian partners, but they might elect to stay within APSIC. So in the second phase of consultation, and some of these issues will be addressed and become more apparent, and thereby we might be able to derive an international... Well, it would be a standardised subscription. It wouldn't be because you're in Australia, it would be this price, and if you're overseas, it would be another, but it would have to be obviously an equal currency. Phil, is there anything that you would like to add to that?
No, I think Michael was curious about the increase for international membership, that's not uncommon for similar bodies for the fee for an international membership to be more expensive than the national membership. And I guess we looked at that and have adopted that sort of view.
If I might just add to that point to Phil, one of the other reasons it was, I think, $10 more was to cover costs associated with postage for healthcare infection. And, of course, that would need to be considered in the context of how is healthcare infection going to be distributed in the future. But as it currently stands, there's some postage costs associated with that. Postage costs internationally, of course, going to be higher than domestic postage costs. So, again, that was part of the thinking for that.
Yeah, that kind of covers it. I mean, I was just curious about if we're promoting ourselves as an Australasian Association, why the membership fee will be different. I mean, I understand the postage costs. I just wondered how large a component that is of the membership fee. So, you know, Brett sort of answered that in a way by saying we have to cover that, obviously. But, yeah, I was just interested in, it just occurred to me if we're going to be Australasian, then it's, I understand other associations have international, but not many of them have a larger region in their title than they cater for their general membership. So, for example, if I'm a US citizen and I have a membership based in Hawaii, then I still have the same subscription fee as any other US citizen. And I know there's a little bit of difference about postage and stuff like that for them, but that's just an example I'm getting at. They cover American citizens wherever they are. We're talking Australasian, but are we really still only an Australian association? That was my point.
Michael, thanks for those comments. I guess, yep. You know, we will really, you know, clearly very seriously look at the responses we get from the online survey because there are a number of options there of names and also the opportunity to for members to offer their own suggested name for the body too. So we'll be reviewing all that information.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Michael. So I'd like to thank you again on behalf of the ACRE executives for tuning in today. Thank you to Phil, representing the work of the Consultative Steering Committee. And a big thank you to Paul Webber from Webber Training for making this event possible. Hopefully those that have tuned in today were either already registered for Webber Training or they will look to review the website regularly to see what types of sessions are coming up. If anyone would like to provide further feedback, members of the Consultative Steering Committee would be very keen to hear from you via the website feedback form. And again, the lines of communication are open to the ACRE Executive and myself as President. You can send any of those queries through to Laurelly via the normal admin at ACRE address. So thank you very much to all of you for your participation today. Hopefully you feel well informed and actively engaged, and we look forward to receiving more comments back on the white paper. Thank you very much to everybody. Well, that concludes the session.